Yetta Chaykin interviewing Dr. Ralph Tomasz. Tuesday, November 19th, the year 2002, for the Jewish Historical Society. Ralph, can you tell me where you were born and something about your parents?
I was born in Wilmington in 1920, and my father and mother were both from Europe. My father got here around 1913, and my mother got here in 1912. Dad came from Romania, Mom came from Belarus, and they were married in 1919, and a year later, I arrived. And we grew up in Wilmington.
How many siblings?
I had a sister who's some 4 or 5 years young, 5 years younger than I am, and I have a younger brother who's about almost 10 years younger than I am.
So you were the older brother.
I was the oldest and the first in the larger family of my mother's side. In fact, on my father's side, he only had a great uncle and aunt here, and a grandmother who was already bedridden and really didn't know anything. So that being the first on both sides, I got kind of extra special care and handling.
And what did your father do?
My father was by training, he was a cabinet maker, but he worked for the Pullman car company that made sleeping cars in those days. And ultimately, he worked in the wood shop. And
did he make a living?
He was a foreman, and he earned a living. And fortunately for us, even during the Depression, although the plant's production was cut back and a lot of personnel were left go, he still was able to continue to work even on a reduced salary. So we personally did not suffer financially like others did, although those days with a family of five, he was earning $35 a week. It was more than nothing, but it didn't go a long way. So
how did the Depression affect you?
Well, we were always conscious of money in the family. My father never had a car. They were very thrifty. I wouldn't say frugal, but they were not extravagant, and they didn't gamble, and always went on a little vacation, but they lived very modestly because of that. And fortunately, we got along much better during the Depression than other people, like our next door neighbors. They didn't work for 4 years. So we were fortunate in that regard. However, we were always conscious of not overspending and not to be extravagant. And the family, my father never even had a car, even after we were all grown.
When you went to college, were you shaped by the Depression? How did it affect you?
Well, to give you an example, I hadn't decided on a career. After I graduated, I was trying to decide on some career, and my father said, "Well, what do you want to do?" And I said, "I want to go to college." He said, "What are you going to study in college?" I said, "I don't know." He says, "I don't have any money for I don't know." I said, "Make your mind up as quickly as you can, because we just have enough to go around for the family." So that was a factor. To give you a little more concrete example, I commuted to the University of Delaware because it was for economic reasons. I could live at home and carry my lunch in a brown bag, which was economical. However, I had, even though my father at that point was making perhaps $45 a week, my allowance was $5 for the week. From that, I had to pay my car fare to Newark and back, and any supplements to my lunch, like ice cream or soda. And I started dating, so I needed dating money. So what I did was hitchhike half the way to save that money, and I would end up at the end of the week with $1.05, and I'd take my future wife to the movies. We walked into town and we spent 90 cents for the movies, and we had enough for ice cream, and started that cycle all over again. And that was pretty good because I know people that didn't have that. There were friends of mine at the college who were, there was an NYA program that the government sponsored for college students to work for the college. And if I remember Phil Dechter, who became a veterinarian, he was a classmate of mine, and he raked leaves for the college for 35 cents an hour, and also to help pay for his board. A lot of fellows were, I worked in the dry goods, well, dry goods on weekends for $3 for the day, and it was a lot of money, but I was glad to have it. And a lot of people had less advantages. I remember a friend, Dr. Harold Friedman, who he was an orphan. His mother was the only one living, and didn't have any resources. And he was at the University of Delaware, and then he got into the University of Pennsylvania Dental School for the first year, but they couldn't have enough money for the second year's tuition. And so he went on into the Army, and when he came out, he was no longer feasible for him to pursue dentistry, and he went into podiatry. So that's an example of difficulties that people faced. A lot of fellows that I knew just couldn't raise the tuition, which was very modest. In 1938, the University of Delaware first semester tuition was $90, which included the $15 chemical breakage fee, and if you didn't break all the glass, you got some back. And the second semester was $60 or $65, and you bought used books, and as I say, hitchhiked most of the way, or some of the guys hitched all the way. There was a riding pool. If you went with the same person, you could get a round trip for 25 cents, and if you only went one way, it cost you 15 cents. So I used to take a ride one way and then hitchhike home. So I saved the difference, so I have some spending money.
So when did you go into the Army?
After I left University of Delaware in 1940, I went to Temple University Dental School. And my beginning of my sophomore year, Pearl Harbor came. And at that point, they accelerated our program, and not by eliminating courses, but eliminating vacations. So we went immediately from one semester to the next with no vacations. And I graduated in October 1943. And simultaneously with the graduation, I was inducted in the Army as a dental officer. And I got married the very 2 days later, and 2 weeks later I was on active duty, and I was in various camps in the East and the Midwest until the following year when I went overseas to Europe.
And you went with what unit?
I was attached to part of the 106th Infantry Division as a dental officer, and we got to England for about a month, and then into the continent. And shortly after we got to the front, the famous Battle of Bulge started, and a very few days later, I found myself a prisoner of war.
So actually, when you went over, the United States
D-Day happened in June of 1944, and I didn't go overseas until October.
Uh-huh. So they were already on the continent.
Well established on the continent, yeah.
So you went over just before the Battle of the Bulge.
Right, because we got into France either the last couple of days of November or the first couple of days of December.
So were you sent in as a replacement for the Battle of the Bulge?
We went in as a unit. The whole division went in as a unit. And we were... Where we were located was supposed to be a very quiet area. And
where was it?
That's on the Belgian-German frontier. Actually, our position was in Germany. We're about 10 or 12 miles into Germany in a very unfavorable defensive position. They didn't want to give it up because they had this toehold in Germany, but it was kind of a retrospect that was foolish because when the battle started, we were in a location where it was difficult to retreat, to get out. We were trapped in a way, and that was a blunder on the general's part.
Who was the general?
Well, it was First Army, and I suppose Eisenhower was responsible, but there was a General Hodges who was charge of First Army, and there was a General Jones who was our infantry division commander.
So you feel as though there must have been some mistakes made?
Well, it was misjudgment.
Yeah.
It was misjudgment. They were planning, the Allies were planning an attack elsewhere, and their attention was there, and the Germans were planning this attack. And the unique thing that I found out about in later years after reading is the U.S. government had broken the German code, so they could anticipate a lot of the things that were happening. And Hitler became aware of that something was wrong, so when they planned this particular battle, they had no radio communication. Everything was transmitted either by writing or word of mouth. And the Allies were focusing their attention elsewhere. And it was in a place where they thought it was unlikely the attack would happen. What they didn't realize or didn't think about that in 1940, when the Germans broke through into France, that they came along the same route. So it was a vulnerable spot, and it was not as well defended, nor was it as defensible in that precise location as it could have been had we been some miles elsewhere.
But were you in front? You weren't
oh,
in
yeah.
front of the... You were?
Right on the front, yes.
But your unit was... I mean, the medical unit traveled...
Oh, no, the way it struck, we were probably a mile and a half...
Behind
the extreme front. But
uh-huh.
by the time we got surrounded, we were in the middle of it. There was,
uh-huh.
there was no front, there was no back.
And so the infantry was in front. Did you have tanks?
No, we didn't have tanks.
Uh-huh.
We had tanks on the sides of us. But the way it worked, the infantry would be spread out on a line, and fortunately, because of this location, we were spread out too far. It was like a 20-mile front for our unit. And there was, and you had three times as many people normally covering that space. So the Germans were able to get through there and behind us. And as far as medical units, there were several echelons of medical support, and I was in the second level. So the first level behind an infantry would probably be 200-300 yards, and the next level was maybe 800 or 1,000 yards where I was. Then it was further level. So with a big breakthrough, the battle that we were involved with started on 16th of December. By the 17th, they were 15 miles behind us.
Who was behind you?
Germans.
The Germans. Oh, so you had
They broke through on the right and left of us,
uh-huh.
of our units. And
so you were trapped.
Yes. And then they...
Did the people in front get caught?
Yeah, we all got, you went to the right and left of us. And
okay.
You were wrapped in like, but not only our division, but there were two other divisions that took a beating there. 28th Division in Pennsylvania, 90th or 99th. So,
were there any other Wilmingtonians?
Well, Herbie Rubenstein was with me in the same medical unit.
Ah, so.
I wasn't right with him. When he was killed, he was maybe a mile or so away from me.
Uh-huh. Did you see, was there a great deal of hand-to-hand fighting?
I don't know. I wasn't that close.
Okay.
Behind that. Probably not. There was some in a little town where one of the breakthroughs fell. Because my aide man went down there as a volunteer. My dental technician wasn't needed, and the chief medical officer called for volunteers. So they went over to this little town. And then they got trapped, and they had to jump out the windows and crawl away and get back to us. So there was that kind of close fighting, but not for me personally.
Was your adrenaline going? Were you frightened?
I was frightened, so I was almost immobilized.
Really?
Well, I did what I was told to do, I wasn't functioning at my best level.
Uh-huh. How about your mates? Were they all in this same sort of shock?
Well, it's hard to say what's under your skin. I know that, you don't know what the person's feeling next
Right.
I didn't run away. They didn't run away, but it felt like it.
Yeah.
But where are you going to go? To give you an example, we knew we were at this point, Dr. Piazza and I were laying on the ground because we'd been under artillery fire for half a day. And then it got quiet and we knew we were going to get captured. And Dr. Piazza said to me, he said, Thomas, what shall we do? I said, I'd like to get the hell out of here. He said, so would I. Where shall we go? I said, I don't know. So I'll give you an idea of how, that's kind of a glib answer, but
yeah.
What could we say? So
so now they come in and they surround you.
Well, the Germans had, we were surrounded in a big way, and then gradually, you know, the circle kept getting smaller and smaller. So at this last moment, we had a little collection of wounded on a hill in the woods, something like Penny Hill,
mm-hmm.
about halfway up the hill. It was a little open space, and we had a bunch of wounded there, and there was a chaplain, myself, Dr. Piazza, Donald McCarron, my corporal, Major Fridline. That little aid area wasn't an aid station, it was just a collection of, and we could hear things, they stopped, the artillery stopped. So it got quiet, and we knew we were going to get captured. So then I could hear the patrols, German patrols were coming up through the woods. Just imagine you're in Bringhurst and they're going up the hill, and one's hollering Hans, the other one's hollering Billy.
What are they hollering?
They're calling each other, Hans and Billy.
Oh.
So then they were down the hill. So the chaplain is laying next to me. He said, Tom, go down there and talk to him because I could speak. He said, go tell him we're medics, not to shoot. Well, the way we were situated, there were a lot of trees and it wasn't a clear view. And all, if you saw somebody moving, it would shoot you. I said, chaplain, I said, if you want to talk to them, you get down. I'm going to wait till they come. Not that I was bravado, but uh-huh. It seemed a prudent thing to do, which was correct. So as they came up and they saw our situation, we had a Red Cross flag and the guys were laying out on stretchers. So I could speak some German and Yiddish. And I went over and talked to the lieutenant, and he realized what we were without that. So he said, well, you know, get your wounded together. And we were in a gully. He said, bring them up on the road, which we did, as many as we could find.
Did you have stretchers?
Yeah, we had stretchers
uh-huh.
and things of that sort, the fellas, stretcher bearers.
Uh-huh.
In fact, Herbie Rubenstein was a stretcher bearer. He got killed. That's a sad story. But in any case, we got as many as we could up on the road and formed a convoy with some of our ambulances that were still running and a truck and a jeep. And because of my limited German ability, I became a Macher. And I was riding on the hood of a jeep with a German military policeman, and we had a stretcher on the hood and two doctors in a jeep and a wounded guy, a driver, and all these wounded that we had collected. We formed a convoy and they took us to a German MASH unit, which it seemed like forever before we got there. That was a country schoolhouse. In the classrooms they made an operating room, and across the road was a barn where we put the wounded.
So did your part of your group operate
yeah,
there?
Yeah, as soon as we got there organized, Dr. Fridline, who's the major chief of a medical officer of our group, he could do ether, so they put him to work doing ether anesthesia. And Dr. Kistner and another, forget his name now, they immediately became surgical assistants. And because I could speak hardly, but enough to be understood,
you could be
I became the expediter.
Uh-huh.
So the wounded were, we got them bunked down in the barn, and
then did the wounded become prisoners of war?
Oh yeah, yeah. So we got everybody laid down in the barn. They all had some kind of wounds. Some could walk, some couldn't. And
were they humane?
Yeah.
When they rounded you up,
they were surprisingly. When we got surrendered, there was no abuse that I could see. They never took my watch, which they did a lot of times. They did. I was just very lucky with the type of people that we interacted with. But And then at the hospital, the German surgeons were very competent.
And where were you taken? Did you stay at one place the whole time?
No.
Okay, where they took you first?
Yeah, we surrendered. We were about 10 or 12 miles inside of Germany, and then must have been another 10 miles back behind the lines. Behind the Siegfried line, where they had this little hospital. They had many of them, but that was
The hospital was behind the Siegfried line.
Yeah. We rode through the Siegfried line. And, but there were, as I say, there were many units like that. And I stayed there because of my language ability, and the three physicians were working. And after the second day, most of the, by the way, the Germans were treating us, our people, as well as the German prisoners, equally well, and they were good surgeons. Unfortunately, their supplies, their technique was good, but their material was limited. They didn't have blood.
You mean their medical?
Yeah, didn't have blood transfusions. There was a colonel that was wounded that we were carrying.
German?
No, American.
American.
Colonel Craig, badly wounded, and he needed a blood transfusion. So he had a match with one of the aid men that was with us. So they did a direct transfusion. They put the donor on a table right next to him and pumped the blood from one to the other. Unfortunately, he was so badly wounded that he died. He had been wounded at around 10 o'clock in the morning. This was around 3 o'clock the following morning.
Oh, wow.
But he was badly hurt. But they didn't have cloth bandages. They had bandages, something like crepe paper, and they'd wrap you up and it would stretch. But they did as well as they could, and I'd say it was very good. And if they had American supplies, it would have been just as well. One of the problems we had was, excuse me, there was a fellow who had a relatively minor wound in the shoulder, but that happened on the 16th, and he wasn't treated for it until the 20th. Well, by that time, he had a certain kind of gangrene, and they had to amputate his shoulder, a whole arm and a shoulder.
Oh, my God.
And then later, he was laying in the recovery area, and he's still all right?
Yeah.
He was in the recovery area, and he became agitated and died. And we presumed that a blood clot kicked off and got his lungs and wiped him out. So things like that, it's depressing. It's bad enough to see him dead, torn apart, but he could have made it very easily had he been able to. But 3 days with that kind of wound is too long. So some very horrendous wounds, it's hard to describe or even think about. But so I stayed in that facility about 2 days or 3 days, and then the volume of work diminished, so the hospital commander told the two other doctors, Kistner and the other one, to go on, to join, get on a truck and go to the next town to go to a prison camp.
And, so you still were not in the prison camp?
No, this was right behind the lines. Well, I got along better with them than I did with the chief medical officer. So I wanted to go with them. He said, no, German commander wouldn't let me. He said, I need you here. Well, they went ahead of us, and they were on a train about 3 days ahead of me around Frankfurt in a rail and boxcars. And that train got bombed by the RAF, and they got killed.
Wow.
And had I been had I been able to go with them, I'd have been right there, right alongside them. Dr. Piazza, who we got separated, but he was on that train, and he picked the pieces up because he knew them and so forth.
So that was a bit of
Kistner and Wemberg were killed. Dr. Piazza is the other dentist who was on that train, but he was not killed. But he was near them. So if I had permission to go with them, I might have been killed too. And I always felt that because of what little crummy German I had, that they have saved my life. So.
That's fascinating.
Yeah.
And so. Ultimately, you did go later.
Oh, to the prison camp?
Yeah.
Yeah, well, I think another 2 days, and the volume of work decreased, so they sent us to the next town, and we were locked in a warehouse for a couple of days. And during that
time, when they locked you in a warehouse, was it dark in there?
Yeah, we were on the second floor, and it was right next to the railroad tracks, just like Penn Station is next to a train, and Americans are bombing the tracks, and the windows are popping open, and you can't get out. It was, you know, frightening. Well, fortunately, we didn't get hit. And by that time, the tracks had been bombed out. So instead of being able to get on a train, boxcar train, as people had preceding us a few days, we started walking, and we walked for a week.
Wow.
And it was bitter cold and no food. I think we had one feeding for the week. And we slept in the barns and schoolhouse floors.
Now, were they with you while you were walking?
Oh, German guards, sure.
Oh, guards.
Guards,
yeah.
Sure. Guards escorting.
So you couldn't have run away.
If you did, you didn't know where you're going to go. So you don't have a map. You don't know where you are. You're already maybe 15, 25 miles behind the lines.
Uh-huh.
And